VentureCast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Music. Horror. Subculture. And overall bad ass. Welcome to Kettle Whistle Radio. With your hosts, Dave and Sean.
So you ready to creep across somebody else's skull like Gino Moreno? Hey, what a great show with Gojira. More on that at some point. And the best part is I was there with, about six other folks. And everybody there had a different show. And I must say I was in charge because I stayed sober. I was the driver that night and nobody else did. What a great show and what a great analyzation of concert goers going six different ways. That was fun. more fun for me. And as you know, I am botanically challenged in all this spring cleaning into the summer and planting now after May or during May has challenged me. And I got bit by a thistle and I'm really pissed about that. And that's just how it goes. However, there is a lot to talk about today and a lot going on in your world too. We're out there too in your world, which kind of creeps across your own skulls, if you will. I got Captain Sexy tonight and very special guest, Mark Netter, talking about his film Nightmare Code. I got to tell you, folks, this movie kind of breaches the contract between you and your little mouse pad, if you will. There's so much good music. We owe a lot of people some airtime, and guys, I'm going to get you on. Give me some time to catch up. Norwegian Soft Kitten, you'll be hearing them. Go listen to them now. You don't need me to do that. We'll have them on. But Norwegian Soft Kitten, that's some great rock and roll right now that you can find. Go everywhere you find them. YouTube immediately, I'll say that. And Flat Spot Records, we got some punk coming your way. That's never going to end until they get tired of me. Also, too, Patrick Ray, little film called Arbor Demon. He's got a few other ones. They're all good. He's consistently nail-biter, I believe. Just great films. But Patrick Ray, R-E-A, yeah, we spell them out here, folks. That's what we do. They Wait in the Dark is coming up. But if you want a little precursor, get a taste of Patrick Ray's films, Arbor Demon. Fun. Very different ending. Different kind of creepy. What are you guys listening to? There's a whole lot out there right now. I see Def Leppard is going nuts right now with, Hair Nation, and they took over. They have their own station, and yeah, we got tickets, and I love them too. But enough's enough sometimes. But hey, you can't get enough of a good thing, or can you? Can you? People have turned on Korn right now, like they did on Nirvana. Yeah, enough of that. What, you just get tired of listening? I don't know what that is. We all do it. We're all guilty, but you're also kind of dumb for turning your back on your favorite band and first love, unless they really did something to piss you off, like shot your girlfriend. That'd be a really weird situation. Now, speaking of weird situations, Captain Sexy's in the house. That was for me. And Mark Netter coming up here. Let me tell you about this film. It is completely what would happen. It's the first film told by an artificial intelligence. All right, and it is available on YouTube, so you can actually watch it. I'm not sure when or how he's going to pull that. That is my tease. But yes, it's a fun movie. Takes two watches, I'll say, to get all of it. Maybe three. There's a lot going on. We're going to decipher it. And until then, we're going to hear a little bit of rock and roll right off the record. And you're going to hear where this comes from as well. Oh, yeah. And on my last episode with Chris Mariano, I did screw up. What else is new, right? In the heat of the moment, The Last Dinosaur was a fun film made, released in Japan, but made here. And made by Rankin and Bass, which makes it stranger. I said Sid and Marty Krofft. I know better. I just had them in my head talking with Chris Mariano. It's hard to not talk Sid and Marty Krofft. But it was Rankin and Bass, who you know them from all those Christmas movies that you guys watched. I watched too, the little puppets and all that. But yes, they made live action films too, a few of them. And one of them was The Bermuda Depths, which is very interesting with Connie Selica and a giant turtle. They did make The Last Dinosaur as well, which is a great dinosaur romp from like the late 70s. I honestly, you've got to see it. I heard that it was released in Japanese theaters back then. I guess the only big screening, probably something in LA at that point too. But Joan Van Ark doing the theme song is and the end credits, probably worth the price of admission. All right, so yeah, redemption song. All right, guys, sit tight and thanks for listening, as always. Yeah, that was my redemption song. But now for Baby Please Don't Go off the Nightmare Code soundtrack. Folks, friends, and fiends, hey, welcome back to your, well, could be your new favorite show, especially you iHeartRadio fans. Welcome back. Thanks for listening. And a new friend, as far as I'm concerned, acquaintance, and yes, also a work partner in some fashion you may hear about at some point, Mark Netter, writer, director, producer of the movie Nightmare Code. And I want to call this, yes, Captain Sexy is with me, I want to call this a cyber phantom horror movie. How do you feel about that?
I love that. Cyber phantom horror movie. I'm digging it.
The director likes it.
I don't know what Sean thinks, but I like it.
Let's see.
I like it. It's definitely sci-fi, so.
Yeah.
And dramatic.
Yes. Sean is more sci-fi than horror, so I like to have that little balance, if you will. But if you find the right horror movie, he's all in. Now, this was, okay, again, you wrote, directed, produced with MJ Rotondi.
Yeah. So Michael Rotondi, my writing partner, MJ Rotondi, could not have done it without him, ultimately became a co-producer on the movie and just has been with me every step of the way on it.
Well, it definitely holds your attention. It was very, my gosh, what a brave way to dive into. Is this your first film?
It's my first feature film.
Okay.
And I made shorts. I'd gone to New York University in the grad film program at Tisch and graduated from that. I'd made films in college, and then I worked for directors and producers when I first got out west in the kind of mid-90s, as an assistant here to them here in Hollywood. So, you know, I kind of knew my way around the set and had experience in, you know, trying to get what was in my head out there for people to see.
You could tell it was not made by an amateur. There was something going on here. And this movie comes with accolades. I'd like to talk about reception. First, we'd like to hear what it's about. How would you summarize your this film, Nightmare Code? Okay.
So Nightmare Code is the first feature film that's told entirely end-to-end from the point of view of an artificial intelligence. We do it with surveillance cams, PC cams, eyeglass cams for at least half the movie. You're watching four images at once like a surveillance monitor. So the movie takes place in a startup where the they're in trouble, they're running behind, there's been a tragedy in the recent past, and they're desperate to finish this program that itself is seems to be taking on a life of its own. And in the same way that the program is messing with the heads of the characters who are trying to finish it inside of the movie, it messes with the audience's head with these different ways it goes in and out of the surveillance, you know, the four surveillance monitors, which the images are not always in sync because the AI, which in the movie is called Roper, Roper is messing with you.
Big time. And when I say brave, those four screens. And I was that was one of the questions. Like, when you see the blurry screen, is that the interaction of the AI coming through? Because I know that, that Sean, you brought that up.
Yeah. I did. I was interested in the reasoning for that, I guess. And
let me ask you a question, because this is it's great that you guys were noticing that. Sean, when you were watching it, did you notice any difference in the blurry screens over the course of the movie? The blurry quadrants, I should say.
I did. I'm trying to think of.
You brought it up first, actually.
I did. I was trying to understand the reasoning.
It bothered him.
It did because
in
I mean,
creepy way.
It was kind of creepy, and it was, you know, what is the what am I? I'm fumbling here.
It feels like it's watching you back. That's how it.
Oh, that's so good. So good.
Kind of.
So,
yeah.
That's
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I can sort of tell you kind of what our thinking was. You know, one of the things that we learned that Roper does in the movie is Roper has the ability to basically change what you see.
It's amazing,
right?
At least as it's recorded, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the way that we saw those blurs was just Roper getting better and better at it over the course of the movie. And if you check out the film, the blurriness is really heavy at the beginning. There's like, you know, different levels of it. And so by the end of the movie, the blurs are kind of clear because Roper is just getting stronger and stronger the whole way through.
Like that was something I wanted to bring up to you. Like, what profession were you involved in? Like before making this film, was it corporate mayhem, or are you more of a technical job, or both?
So, you know, my background was I had gone to graduate school in New York University in grad film, and then I'd come out to LA and worked on features. And then I got dragged into the video game business by a good friend of mine that I made through a friend at film school, a guy named Jordan Mechner. And Jordan's the kind of legendary video game creator. He created the Prince of Persia series, and we created a game called The Last Express that I produced. And I learned how to work with programmers at that point. And I learned what it meant to be in crunch time, because when you're programming a game, especially one with some, at the time, cutting-edge technology, it is just endless, and it's torture. And then I worked for a mobile social network startup that was venture capital funded in the mid 2000s, a company called Xanel, and saw again kind of how that worked. What were the corporate pressures? What were the, you know, things that the leaders were trying to get you know, accomplished for investors while the or customers while the programmers were, you know, struggling to make deadlines and fighting the code. So. I've had a lot of programmers who have seen Nightmare Code tell me that it feels accurate to their experiences, and some say too accurate and too scary, so which I consider a great compliment. So it really is informed by, and also my partner, my writing partner, MJ Rotundi, had worked kind of in tech and associated with Wall Street. So we kind of knew that milieu, and we knew how those companies functioned, what kind of pressures they'd be under, and how programmers talk, and how you know, QA people that test the software talk and work, and what their personalities might be like. So we were able to make that pretty authentic based on those experiences.
Well, I'll say it's effective. Sean, part of Sean's life is, well, his occupation is computers. So when he sees a blurry screen, he's got to wonder what the heck's going on here. But when it became creepy, that's when I was like, oh, it must have hit a mark, quite literally, no pun intended, with him, because he's just like, the four screens, and they go blurry on you, and it's like creepy. And I'm like, yeah. And I had to ask you, is it looking back? Because we're both fans of like the Mothman and movies where you just feel a presence, but you can't find it. You don't know where it is, but it's watching all the time. Were you going for that?
Yeah, there's a real meta feel to Nightmare Code, but I don't think it's like the meta of just the director talking. It's the meta of the program talking. So the way that when I got into the editing with my editor, Kyle Goodrich, we basically thought of it as, why is Roper making this cut here? Why is Roper going full screen here to show us something? Oh, he's showing it because he wants you to know there's like a knife in the place. You know, there are different things that Roper does because he's trying to manipulate you, create some fear, misdirect the audience at various times. And ultimately, we felt that the, you know, this is kind of, when you get really well-directed films like by like a Kubrick or a Scorsese, you feel a director's hand in there and it feels, you're happy because the director is kind of leading you along, but it can be brutal at times. And we kind of thought of Roper as the filmmaker being, you know, basically at all points trying to express in the most effective ways its power to the audience. Because our feeling is that what the movie ultimately is trying to say is some things about technology. And one of the things that I learned about technology while working in it is that you can't really ever keep it a secret. Like, you know, you can't really, technology always will out at some point. What happens when that technology is an AI that doesn't necessarily have our best interests at heart?
You sound like Ian Malcolm talking about dinosaurs.
Perfect.
But yeah, we got some character questions too. Uh-huh.
So you had an actor from who also appeared on our fans of this show might know from The Walking Dead, played by Andrew West. Are you part of the process for the selection for the film, for the actor selection, or do you leave that to the talent agencies, or how does that work for you?
Oh, that's a great question. Okay, so, you know, typically if you're directing, I would argue your number one job is working with actors, almost above anything. You can hire someone to write, you can hire someone to shoot, pick the shots, but you need to be the only voice the actors hear. So you want to, you know, have a hand in approving, you know, choosing every single actor. In our case, we were an independent feature film. It's a small movie from a budget stance, but big in terms of ideas. It was always funny when people would ask the actors, oh, is it a little movie? And they'd be like, well, what do you mean? You know, or they say it's a big movie. They say, what do you mean by big? But so what happened in this case, again, because this movie was made on a super low budget, and even though it's got like 500 visual effects shots in it, and, you know, it was shot for under $100,000. It was finished for around $200,000. I mean, it's a real triumph of people that were excited about the subject matter and all that. And I needed to go find actors, and I actually called my friend Jordan, and he knew a guy named Jamie Wohlrab, who is a coach for actors here in LA and an actor himself, and actually appears in the movie in the opening early boardroom scene. And Jamie read the script, and we met up in a bar, and he said he loved the script and he wanted to help, and he pulls out his phone and I pull out my phone, and we start looking at people that he knows who are professional actors. And we got most of our cast through Jamie. And thanks to our line producer, who herself was just out of NYU, 23 years old, she knew Mae Melanson, who plays Nora in the movie.
She's amazing.
Well, Mae's amazing. Mm-hmm. And Mae knew Andy because they shared a commercial agent. So she had recommended Andy. And so we'd seen a lot of people for Nora and for Brett. And we had seen them over, you know, a period of time. And nobody was quite right. There was one guy I went out to for his character, and then he didn't want to do it. And I'm so glad he didn't take it. And when I finally met with each of them separately, with Andy and Mae, it was always for coffee at night. So I met, you know, and it was at the same place in Westwood, this place that doesn't exist anymore called the Novel Cafe. And Mae came and we talked for 3 hours.
Wow.
And she said something to me so great when she was leaving. She said, well, you know, she really looked forward to doing this movie because she could do things in it that she doesn't get to do a lot in other movies.
Okay.
And I said, oh, I'd always thought it was like, because, you know, her character becomes very strong by the end of the movie and becomes essentially kind of like a little bit of, you know, it's kind of, you know, the old Last Girl thing, but she has a bit of an action.
Oh, I almost said that. I was going to say that would be a spoiler, but Last Girl, right?
Yeah, kind of there, right?
But kind
of. And I like the idea that the movie kind of moves from Brett's point of view to her point of view by the end. And she said, and I said, oh, so is it because you get to do things that guys usually get to do in the movies? And she said, no, it's I get to make choices.
Yeah.
And she really loved the choices that Nora got to make. And then she introduced me to Andy, meet Andy the same place a week later, 3-hour coffee, you know, not expected to be 3 hours either time. And just adored the guy. And he went back and the thing he said to me was he loved that this guy had such a solid objective. He plays a programmer, Brent Desmond, who is brought in to this startup where the previous lead programmer, the genius behind this Roper program, has gone crazy. He did a murder suicide, killed a bunch of executives, killed himself in the office. There's still blood on the walls.
Yeah.
And Brett is sleeping in. He has to finish this program within a month because that's the deadline. And he's under pressure because he did something very bad in a previous job in Chicago.
Yep.
So you see Brett in the office and he's talking to his wife and daughter over Skype. And, you know, he's starting to become close with the people that are working there testing the program, including Nora and 3 other QA people. And so, you know, when Andy sent us, after I met with Andy, he went home and he recorded himself doing some of the scenes and sent them to us. And I saw them and I was just crazy excited. And I sent them to MJ Rotundi, my writing partner and producing partner. And we both thought that it was the first time that we had seen our character, the way we'd written it from all the people that had, the actors who had auditioned. And with May, it went even further. With May, we saw the character, when she did sent us some video, we saw the way that the character should be. And we actually rewrote the part for her and made it more mature. And kind of, you know, she had a big effect on kind of that role. And it was really eye-opening. So I adored the casting process. And then I adored working with both of those actors and everybody else.
That's amazing to me as a writer that, you know, you could actually meet somebody that's going to play the role of something you wrote, and somehow the role becomes bigger and better. I guess that it gets beyond what you initially had intended. And that is always probably a great, lovely surprise for you.
Well, I think that's the definition of a good actor. Like a good actor takes what hopefully is decent writing and turns it in. And I mean, they can't save shitty writing, but what they can do is they can take your thing and bring something to it. They bring some life experience. They bring some emotion. They bring some technical skills. But ideally, they're bringing a point of view about their character, and they really embrace it. You know, they need to be the expert on their character, you know, when we're on set. They should know more about the character than I do. And, you know, when you work with somebody like May, she actually asks you a series of questions that you work on together about her character. So she understands the backstory, that you make it feel very rich. Even stuff you may not necessarily notice when you see on screen, it just makes it feel more real. So that was a, you know, it was a great experience. And then the third kind of, you know, major actor in this major role is that of, you know, the previous programmer who's lost his mind, Foster Cotton. And he was actually, he's been an actor longer than anybody else in the movie. He's been an actor for, you know, since the 80s. And Googie Gress, and just a great guy who was actually the coach of my son's softball team.
Oh my God, I bet
baseball
you,
team.
Do you still look at him the same way? Or?
Well, this was so funny. So I start writing this with Roto. I mean, it's kind of funny story how we started on this thing, but we wrote it in 40 days because the guy who put up the money originally, my executive producer, Craig Allen, who's, you know, the movie wouldn't exist without Craig. You know, he had wanted to see a script, and so we wrote as fast as we could. But I'm writing this, and then I'm going out to the baseball practice, and I keep looking at Googie because I'm thinking, like, okay, you're a deranged programmer who is now tormenting people beyond the grave.
He's quite the presence.
Right, and in real life is like a teddy bear.
You know, I could probably tell that. You answered the question. I wanted you to develop Brett Desmond, the lead character, but you definitely got into him. Sean had a question, but you sort of covered it.
Please.
Yeah, you kind of covered it. It was you had brought up Foster, and we wanted to know if, you know, does he play the monster, or is the code the monster in the film?
Well, now you're asking the question that I'm asking the audience, right?
Ah.
So we're asking the audience, is the code haunted? Is the code just an unbelievable AI? Did Foster enter the code in some spiritual way, or did he just program it in such a way that it reflects his personality?
Yeah.
And if you talk to programmers, see, a lot of us, you know, especially before I got into the you know, working with programmers, I thought, you know, everybody would approach a programming problem the same way and the code would look the same. 10 programmers had the same problem, the code would look the same at the end of the week or the end of the day or whatever.
Not true.
No, it's not true. And in fact, I remember they would test programmers that would come in to join, you know, a team at a game company I was working at. And they would give them a problem and they do it up on the board and write some code. And I distinctly remember our lead programmer, I walked in one time and he goes, ah, we did it totally differently. We thought about it differently and did it totally differently, but this works great. And programmers then started told me as I was working on Nightmare Code that programming has like the fingerprints of the programmers all over it. The way that they think, the way that they comment the code and things that you know, are hidden in the code that you just see if you're programming, that it all is essentially like a fingerprint. So that's what's behind the question that you're asking right there. And I would ask you, what do you think happened?
Man, without giving spoilers, it's kind of like, I always like to believe in the supernatural. But it's easier to believe that maybe you had an evil guy who died because they, spoiler alert, they do say they saw a presence, a phantom smoke, something go from the person to the screen or to the computer in one of the shots. Mm-hmm. So that makes me believe in monsters too. But is it the spirit of a guy, or do we just leave it ambiguous? I don't know.
Well, I think that's part of the fun of the movie.
I agree.
You know, and I kind of go back and forth myself, but I do think that we, so, you know, it's funny because one of you is a little more horror, one of you is a little more sci-fi, right? That's what I'm hearing.
A little bit country, a little bit rock and roll, you know.
One of the inspirations for this movie was that I'd seen a found footage script and thought, oh my God, it doesn't look that hard to write one of those movies. Of course, I was wrong. But
yeah.
And we really studied like the horror genre in writing it. You know, I love science fiction. I'm more of a sci-fi guy than a horror guy. But, you know, movies like The Thing or Alien are my kind of horror movie because they're really based in science. And my favorite horror movies are The Shining and The Witch because they're the only ones that scare me.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm not a big like slasher guy. I mean, I love action at the movies. You know, I don't mind blood. I mean, I love The Northman, you know, which I just thought was a bloody near horror movie.
Yeah.
But you know, the idea of, you know, that there's some brains behind it and that it can work on different levels, that there's interesting concepts, but also viscerally there's points where, you know, when we would show it at festival screenings and things like that, the audiences would verbally react to, you know, what's coming up on the screen. But, you know, I think the scariest thing in the whole movie, and this would be a spoiler, so I want to be careful about it.
Right.
Is there's a moment late in the movie where Roper really betrays Brett, the program, the computer program, destroys Brett's life.
Oh yeah.
And I can tell you, well, I don't know how you guys felt when you were watching it, but when we see that in screenings with the public, it's like you hear people at different parts of the theater realize what's happening at different points, like very quickly, and it just builds. And you know, it's so gratifying when there's noises coming from the audience.
Oh, absolutely, that's what you live for. And we're gonna get into that because I'm gonna inch around that and not spoil that scene after this really quick break, folks. And we're right here. I always say this because I don't like radio shows where they go through a 40-minute thing. They don't re-announce who you're talking to, what you're talking about. We got Mark Netter, okay, writer, producer, director of Nightmare Code, and it is available to watch for a limited time, maybe, or maybe it's there for a long time. But we'll let you know after the break where you can find it, and we'll wrap things up here with Mr. Netter as well. And do we have some good hot questions for you, my friend.
I can't wait.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Be right back.
Hi, this is Martin Atkins from Public Image Limited, Killing Joke, Ministry, Nine Inch Nails, Pig Face and the Damage Manual and Murder Inc. and Brian Brain, and you're listening to Kettle Whistle Radio.
I'm not afraid of the dark, but you should be. There are things that dwell here in the dark. things. Best left unseen.
With the initial smoke clear from the fall of tomorrow, the blood now flows even thicker with Dwelling in the Dark. 11 stories. All bits of the same mysterious puzzle, fitting together with horrific parallels to its predecessor. Get ready for new, truly terrifying tales set in the broken world from the fall of tomorrow. Take a closer look at what's now dwelling in the dark. If you dare. Available on Amazon in traditional print and ebook. Get your copy today. Visit www.fairlydarkproductions.com for more info on the author and his work.
Okay, as usual, all the best conversations happen off the air, and Sean is always the reason for that, as you picked out you guys have a similar interest in a film and one of my favorite books. It is a sci-fi book.
I still want to read the book, but yeah.
I didn't know there was a book.
Yeah, it's a Scottish author. I have it, actually, it's underneath me in my library somewhere, and I've yet to give it to Sean. And they follow it pretty darn close, and that is In the Skin, right?
Under the skin.
The book, I think it's also called that. It's very disturbing. Scarlett Johansson plays, well, if you want to call it an alien, sure. Oh boy, that's an intense.
But it's a presence that's there, yes. Kind of like in your film that's you know, always there. And we were talking earlier about The Thing. You had mentioned and you know, there's an obvious sort of tone there with a presence being there and always watching and you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I think is fascinating about horror movies, like, you know, I think I sort of told you guys, I'm not a huge horror fan. I don't seek it out all the time, but I do seek out what people today call elevated horror.
Okay.
You know, like The Shining, The Witch, The Thing, the, you know, Alien. And what's fascinating, and also, by the way, there's tons of movies and TV shows that have horror elements. There's times when I'm watching Euphoria where I think they're, you know, using horror tropes to scare the hell out of us.
Oh, I agree.
But I think the thing that's really fascinating about horror movies is that once they start to kick in, they activate the whole frame. So you're, especially if you're in a movie theater, you're watching and, you know, a lone guy or a lone woman are walking into a room and we know something bad is about to happen. We're feeling dread. And we're looking all behind them. We're looking at the corners of the frame. We know something's going to happen. We don't know where it's going to come from. So that's that sense of presence you get in horror. And in our film, I think we take it another level because, you know, if all the shots are essentially being chosen by the horrific presence, you know, that creature that's trying to come in from the other world, you know, then that really puts you, hopefully, you know, even more on edge. And I think the people that understand the movie, you know, really get that feeling and they get that sense.
Well, that's goes right back to Mothman, because that's what freaked me out, is when you get the point of view, what could be the Mothman watching what's happening and what he's, what his web of deceit, if you want to call it that. I dig that when you get the monster's point of view. And I kind of like Jaws. It's the same thing, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, Jaws opens with the monster's point of view, and then the most famous one was the first Halloween movie, where basically you're Michael Myers, and you even get to the point where he finds the mask, puts it on, and now we're looking through two mask holes. And like, I'm remembering that from, what is it now, like 40 odd years ago when I saw that in the movie theater. I haven't seen it since, but I'll never forget that scene. So, you know, that idea of presence, I think, is really fun to play with, and you know, hopefully we did it in sort of a new way, because we're talking about artificial intelligence, which, you know, is here.
And it's huge. So before we broke there, again, we're talking to Mark Netter, producer, writer, director of Nightmare Code. We are talking Nightmare Code. There's a scene, and it goes right back into that ambiguity, and you could give the spoiler or not. There's a sex scene that may or may not take place. Are you willing to answer that?
Well, I think it definitely does take place.
Okay.
But I think that that's kind of where things, you know, that's the point that kind of triggers things going off the rails for
blurred
for the last part of the story, you know, for like the kind of brings us into the sort of waterfall of bad news that happens, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the, you know, second act and leads us into the climax. So, but it's interesting that you thought it might be ambiguous whether it happened or not. You know,
the first time, the first time I watched it, then I kind of really picked up on it.
I'm good either way, but you know, it's funny. The, you know, the kind of, one of the behind the title. So our movie is called Nightmare Code, and that refers to computer code first most, you know, in the programming business, sometimes people say, oh, that guy wrote spaghetti code, meaning that it's crazy to follow the logic and it's too twisted. And, you know, if you're a new programmer being brought in to work on a code that on someone's code, that's spaghetti code or really bad code, they actually do call nightmare code. So that was the idea behind the title from the most literal point of view. But we also felt that the term code is really about codes of behavior, and that in all kind of movies and TV shows that you watch, you know, generally what you're watching are characters that are dealing with some sort of codes of behavior, whether it's the cop code or the mafia code, or whether it's the, you know, marital code or whatever it might be. And what we were thinking is that technology is changing the codes of the way that we treat each other, our human behavior.
Mm, yeah, algorithms.
Yeah, exactly right. And that, you know, there's things that happen now. Like, for example, we give over our decision-making process to computer code all the time. We may set things up in advance, alarms, alerts. There are programs that will write to us even, you know, without a human pushing a button because things have been set up in such a way. And now you have artificial intelligence, which can, you know, literally improve itself as code through trial and error at a blazingly fast speeds. So, you know, I don't know if have things changed, you know, if somebody has traveled far away and they are communicating with a loved one over Skype, do they feel closer to that person than they would have, you know, 30 years ago when they couldn't have done that?
Hmm.
Or does it actually ultimately make them feel more lonely?
That is such a totally, wow, that's a big time different perspective that I never even thought of.
Yeah, you know, it's, you build all these things in there and you hope that they at least, even if people don't necessarily, you know, talk about those specific things after they see the movie, hopefully it affects them in some way.
I joke around and I call Facebook the time tunnel because there are people I probably haven't talked to in 20, 30 years and now we have these relationships again. And sometimes maybe you're not mm-hmm. supposed to, you know, and as far as nightmare, well, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen people do all kinds of things, you know, there was a, I don't know if, you know, remember Citadel, which Facebook's first shopping tool.
Oh, wow.
And if you bought something on Citadel, it automatically posted to your feed automatically. So people were getting busted for birthday gifts.
Oh, no.
Give, you know, a loved one. Or they were getting busted for gifts that they were giving to their mistress or, you know, the person they were cheating with. Like, oh, you bought me flowers? But why didn't I see that?
You know? Oh, that's fair. And that's like, hence the gasps that you heard in the theater during screenings. That I think whatever is shown will just say, it's a lot of folks, it would be their worst nightmare that gets broadcasted to the one person you don't want to ever see it. And that is a true nightmare. I mean, you scored.
Yeah, or the two people you wouldn't want ever to see it.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I forgot about that. Yeah. I wasn't going to give that away, but I actually forgot about, yeah, there's H. Well, no, I'm not going to say, we'll just say her name's Lacey.
Lacey's fantastic.
That poor kid. But yeah, I think I am Sean's nightmare code. Sometimes I just text them zeros and ones and let them figure it out. 5 years running. Tell me I'm lying.
You're not. I get your texts all hours in the night.
Do you do that to your partners too?
I do not do that to my wife or anyone else. I try to avoid it.
I have weird hours. You can blame Sean for my weird hours too, because anyway, partially, we won't get into that either. It has to do with job and occupation. But all right, so there is also, because we love music on the show, and we listen to, of course, Baby Please Don't Go earlier by Joseph Lee Williams.
Big Joe Williams, I think, probably did one version of it.
Okay.
Yeah, Yeah, we wanted to do our own version of it, so we recorded it and did kind of almost like a punk rock version.
Yeah, I love it.
For the end credits. But, you know, and this is not a big spoiler, but one of the threads in the movie is that one of the ways that you can kind of tell that Roper is infecting people is they start humming Baby Please Don't Go.
Yes. As a matter of fact, my wife was coming in and out of the room and she's just like, you know, you need to ask him about the blues thing. Is there an underlying blues inference going on here too? Was that just your taste in music, or is this something you wanted to convey?
Well, what did you guys think? Did it make you, did it bring up any associations? Did it feel like it made sense, or was it more confusing for you?
I personally, when I write and when I love music when it comes to any storytelling, and if it's affiliated, I don't think a director makes a mistake in that case, if you're asking me that.
So our feeling was that so many tech movies you see that are about technology, it all takes place in a very modern space and everything is very, you know, kind of modern or slightly futuristic or whatever it is. And we love the idea that there was some sort of ancient evil behind Roper.
Ooh.
That goes back to like the Delta Blues or maybe even beyond.
Oh, man.
And that by having this kind of viral tune that moves from Cotton to Brett over the course of the movie would be a way to have this kind of ancient thread of evil that, you know, wasn't just from the digital age, it was from the pre-digital age.
Okay. No, that you just got the synapses going for me. Now I'm thinking maybe he's thinking prequel and going way back. Like, you know, New Orleans or something, you know.
I definitely thought more about sequels and ways to continue the story because, again, not to give out spoilers, but there is something that happens at the end that opens the movie up in a big way. So there are thoughts about where that could go. And whether that would be maybe in a scripted podcast or another film script, you know, we have to see.
Okay. Well, you definitely got some accolades, and I noticed that watching the trailer, of course, but I'll say them out loud right now. But the New Filmmakers of New York Fall Series, it was 2014, and the Philip K. Dick Science Fiction Film Fest in 2015. Then I saw one I'm not familiar with, Winter Shriek Fest. You got Best Film.
Shriek Fest, yeah.
I'm not
best
familiar
thriller,
with that.
Best Thriller, yeah.
Is that, okay.
Shriek Fest is a really great, it was our launch and it was our world premiere, and it's an LA film festival that's been going on for a long time. Denise Gossett, who runs it, is an actress and also just a great film festival, you know, person. She and the film got the festival had gotten these accolades from filmmakers. Mm-hmm. We sent her the movie, and they had really just about closed the you know, we were past kind of the deadline for entry or just on the edge. And she basically warned me and said that she, you know, it might not even be able to be seen in time. You know, she has people that look at the movies for her to prejudge. She calls me at 11 a.m. the next morning because she had just watched the movie herself, as there was no one else to give it to. There wasn't time. And she was like, I want your movie in our festival.
Hey, and so, that's what you want.
So we were just very happy about that. And then the Philip K. Dick Film Festival in New York was very meaningful to us because for your listeners who, you know, hopefully a lot of them are Philip K. Dick fans, but he's the great science fiction writer who basically died just as his career was taking off in the movies with Blade Runner and, you know, The Man in the High Castle. And, you know, he's just, there's a Total Recall. All of these and many more are from him. And then a lot of things like The Matrix are essentially his ideas that have been, you know, adapted or transmogrified by creators. So, you know, we were thinking a lot about Philip K. Dick really was very much in the paranoid tradition of science fiction, whether it was sort of an invasion of the body snatchers type stories that he would tell about people being taken over. But his most kind of famous trope is that you'll be in a story and, you know, following a certain character and turns out that character's reality is not anything of what you or that character thought, and it'll switch halfway through the story, and then you'll find out there's a much bigger world and crazier things going on, and a lot of it is due to technology that has now been warping the way that we think. So winning the Philip K. Dick Film Festival in New York with Nightmare Code, with our little low budget, you know, sci-fi horror thriller, was just it was just kind of a dream come true.
Yeah, man. I mean, this was like a code that was made with good intentions, and then like a Frankenstein effect just takes place during the film, or even after, or what was it like the reception from people? I know you spoke a little bit about gasps in the audience, but what else did they have to say? Too real? Too scary?
Well, you know, I think people were able to identify with the characters, you know, and that, you know, the, particularly, you know, there's a lot of different characters in the movie, even though it's kind of, you know, in a sort of enclosed setting. You have, you know, different QA testers and different people that are kind of, you know, fun to watch and, yeah, and follow. But you know, Andrew J. West and May Melançon, they're so good together. They have great chemistry. And they're both very committed to their roles, and they're, you know, they were fantastic to work with, and they're very truthful as actors. So I think that people kind of related to these issues. I mean, you know, Brett's a guy with a kid who's kind of fucked up his job and is kind of desperate to make the next one work. I don't know. I've been through that in my life. Mm-hmm. I know other people have.
Yeah.
You know, there's in various degrees. So, you know, that idea, and then being under pressure to get something done, that's where, as you're working on it, the goal seems more and more elusive every day, because as Roper, you know, rewrites itself as code and is more taking on a life of its own, it's sort of like the closer you get, the further away you get. So I think people related to that. And then, you know, with May, you know, being this person who's kind of in a little bit of a searcher, you know, she's, you know, gotten out of some bad relationships, she's trying to find herself, and she's, you know, making something of herself, and now she's, you know, suddenly comes across this thing in the workplace that is, you know, horrific and life-threatening and actually is, you know, kills people. I mean, it's kind of a fun person to kind of identify with.
Yeah.
And one of the things that May brought to the role too was the idea of her having these panic attacks that come from her backstory. And it may be a little subtle, but you may notice in the movie there's points where she gets hit with these panic attacks and she kind of can't function, but ultimately she overcomes, which is, you know, kind of, I think, something that the audience is related to. And I think that we all relate. I think audiences really related to the technology side of it. I mean, we are so, you know, at this point, technology is so integrated into our lives that we kind of know a lot of the things that happened in the movie are almost like second nature, that, you know, even things like that whole surveillance monitor look of the movie and storytelling, you know, would that have, I don't think it would have worked being that persistent if it was 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
Oh, you definitely scored that feeling, that diabolical presence. You definitely, from the onset, I felt it.
Good. I mean, I do feel the movie, you know, it kind of starts with a bang and then it kind of slow burns for about, you know, half an hour, and then, you know, everything starts hitting the fan.
And we did say, we mentioned earlier about Nora being the final girl, but really, guys, folks, friends, and fiends, that's not a spoiler. There's a lot going on there, and she, in a sense, really is not the final girl. And I can't say anything else about
that's
that.
True.
I cannot say really anything else after that. Let's see here. Also, too, this is for both of you being techies. I think this the good intentions about the pitch that he had for this tech company to buy this program, that was the allure. Do you think that any tech company would buy into this idea, like an Elon Musk type, the good intentions of seeing what people are feeling?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right,
so
now,
here's what's fascinating about this. So, you know, and maybe Sean has a different opinion on this, but so 12 years ago, or pardon me, 10 years ago, when we shot this movie, you know, we did a big search. We wanted, you know, what are they working on? Well, behavior recognition software sounds fascinating. There was no behavior recognition software. By the time we released the movie, there was already several companies that were doing behavior recognition software. And it was all kind of similar to our idea about it, that if you have cameras that are feeding into a computer, and, you know, the name of our program is Roper because it ropes in all the video in the area. That's where it came from. So it's roping in all this video and it's able to analyze it. And the way that artificial intelligence works is that if you give it a set of rules and then help it to figure out its mistakes along the way, it will self-correct and learn. So the idea that, you know, things that we do in our behavior that before technology might have seemed mysterious or, you know, open to interpretation, that they actually become just data points that can be, if you have enough data, right, you can know what the trends are. Mm-hmm. So why not have a behavior recognition program that can tell us if somebody walking into an airport as a terrorist.
That was brilliant. You know, yeah.
So this behavior recognition software now does exist. It is a relatively big business and used for security. So, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons why you'd want to use Roper, although, again, in kind of a George Orwell, you know, science fiction warning kind of way, do we really want to be using behavior recognition software?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, if you tell me it's accurate, is that good? Or is that actually still don't want to use it? Still too intrusive.
You hear Jet in the background. She does join the show every now and then. I think we heard your puppy earlier.
Yeah, you heard Leon. Yeah.
They're saying hi. Yeah, Sean's getting a little nervous now because he knows I'm going to ask him if he's behind a certain nightmare code where he works right now.
No, but I mean, a lot of what we do where I work is based on predictive analysis and, you know, automation and, uncovering things before they become things, that sort of stuff. But
yeah, and which again, Minority Report, another movie based on a book or a story by Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Who was predicting this before anybody. I mean, Philip K. Dick is writing about this stuff in the 1960s.
It's amazing. Yeah. I have a close friend that's all he read everything he did. And he's introduced me since. And there's also a film you could see or a series on, I think, Prime. His short stories, I think.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I think it is. I forget the name of it.
Me too.
But I think there is one.
Philip K. Dick's Nightmares.
They may have called that Electric Dreams. Actually.
Electric Dreams. I think so.
Yeah, I think it is Electric Dreams.
I think you're right. Correct. You are right. But back to script here. I gotta say, Brett Desmond. He does that typical Hollywood taking a lot of pills thing. is this a red herring into how we see him and his perception, or is this just a prescription?
I think it should say something about his character, you know, that he is, relying on things to be able to get through, his high pressure situation that he's living in. It's really a guy on the edge, and and I think what happens in the movie is that the code takes him over the edge.
Big time. And poor Lacey, I this is for me because I had to ask this, and I think this is part of it. I'm not going to get into the other part, but Brett Desmond's daughter, Lacey, she's having nightmares, and the wife tells him, because they're basically Skyping each other or using, you know, Zoom, whatever they're using it. But she's having nightmares, and was she infected because she came in and talked to her father through a computer? Is she having night? Were they just saying? Was she like typical kid nightmares?
Well, again, it's sort of a great ambiguity, and you kind of have like a great answer there, right? I mean, you know, again, if we go with the idea that technology will always out, technology will out, was kind of behind everything. So why wouldn't some of the technology seep in through whatever they're using? You know, if you go on to if you're a guest on somebody's internet, you have no idea what they can put on your machine or what they can see that you're doing on your machine.
Right. Right.
Right.
Yes. And have both of you worked in offices quite like this? Cause I know I did.
Oh yeah. No, very much so. And in fact, this was again, Craig Allen, our hero, executive producer whose company, Spark Unlimited, was the first financiers for Nightmare Code. We actually shot in their offices on weekends. Now, the movie was shot over the course of 7 weekends 10 years ago, starting this upcoming month, June. And, you know, we would basically take this video game office and redress it to be more stripped down. We built a hallway. We built stuff in there that, you know, you wouldn't know was fake, but is there. And, that's a real place that people work. And that is the kind of programmer startup environments that, I've seen before in the past.
Well, before we wrap things up here, I just want to say, Sean may or may not have something else here for you, too, after I say this. But, Mark, the real genius behind your film is the setting, and that's what you were building on right there. All horror movies. Okay, phone's dead, car won't start, doors are locked. Your Nightmare Code can do all that by itself and more.
So you set the standard, and from the onset of the film, this place is all cammed. They even say it. Instead of somebody that's running with a camera through the woods, which I'm very tired of, because most people would just run or throw the camera at whatever's chasing them, or they have to be on their phone throughout the entire film, FaceTiming everybody. That gets tiring to watch. What you did was, there's a reason why all this is happening, and it's not in your control.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. You know, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of found footage movies. I went to the theater to see Blair Witch Project.
Right.
Unfortunately, didn't sit in the back of the theater, so I was nauseous for about, the entire time. but we like that these were really motivated. You know, like, I love the movie Chronicle, but there's a point about two-thirds of the way through Chronicle, or several points in the movie, but definitely towards the end, where you're like, wait, where are they getting this footage from? Wait, how are they justifying this shot? And
there you go.
It's a little silly. So we really, it's funny, because when I would meet with actors, particularly in supporting roles, and they would be like, okay, when am I getting a close-up? And I say, well, there's a couple times where you're in front of a computer, so you'll get a close-up because the computer will be taking, video of you and feeding it into Roper.
Right.
Not everybody understood that the whole way, but when they did, it was interesting. And I also love the very architectural side of it. I'm a huge Stanley Kubrick fan, and this movie is influenced as much by 2001: A Space Odyssey as it is.
Oh, I could feel that. Now that you say that. Wow. Yes. I totally feel that.
Yeah. I even had a running scene I was going to do where Brett was going to be running through the office getting exercise using the eyeglass camera.
Right.
To kind of mimic the running on the when they go to Jupiter. But
it's so cool.
But I like the kind of architectural feel of those. And I like that, a lot of times with Kubrick, you kind of know where you are. Like, you start to get a kind of a mental picture of the space. So what I really liked about the way that we decided to shoot Nightmare Code was because we're using these fixed surveillance cameras and these PC cameras, and occasionally what looks like handheld, because the actor is literally wearing a pair of sunglasses that have a video camera, right in the middle, that you would get a sense of the space, and that the first times the first half of the movie, you're learning about the office, you're learning about the front door, the elevator, you're learning about where the different, kind of get a visual, sort of a visceral sense of where everything is in the office. So that when we get to the, last third of the movie and, people are running through the office and bad things are happening, that it has kind of taken the space that you've come to learn about and activated it and made it a very scary space. And hopefully that worked for everybody.
I'd say it definitely works. Yeah. And also notice, I can't let you go without asking about your writing credits musically as well. All Go Down, you wrote the song?
Oh, All Go Down. Yeah, there's, I think, did I take a credit for something in there?
Yeah.
There's, I do a little bit of music writing. My partner at Electrocast is actually a professional musician, writer, producer, with 30 number one hits. So he's kind of knows that stuff. But, I've always really enjoyed music. I like having a hand in it. I was a music supervisor on 3 Olympic broadcasts just at the start of my career.
Wow.
So, very into it, and love impressing my kids when I tell them what concerts I went to back when I was their age.
Very cool. Yeah, it threw me off. It's one of the few credits I was looking at the credits. I always do that. When I saw, earlier we were talking about Baby Please Don't Go, and it was performed by four different people. They all got credit, and I was like, wait a second, whose song is that? And then, of course, it's none of theirs. But again, great version of that song. And music has a big part of your writing, or is it vice versa?
I definitely listen to music when I'm writing, and I get things that keep me in the mood. I am a big blues fan. I find that of all the music that has lyrics in it, the only thing that I can really focus on at work is when it's blues. For some reason, pop and rock, I'm like drawn away and I can't focus, but the blues keeps me focused, which is great. And I think that one tune that I've credited with in the movie is like a source track. It's something playing in like a background somewhere that I had done. But we had a really great composer, Ari Baluzian, who is, again, came in through my line producer, who has been, friends with him since childhood. His main instrument of choice is the electric viola. And I went to see him do a concert with the viola with some other people that he put together in a band, including a guy who's a great trumpet player and all that. And I'm like, this is the feel of the movie. This is great. So, you know, all that underscore that at times sometimes even feels like the pulse of the building that you're in. That's all from Ari. And then I asked him to, you know, do that version with Andrea Adolph of Baby Please Don't Go.
Right.
She's the vocalist on it. And I really wanted to end the movie with like a kind of a rock and roll feel. You know, I love the idea that, you know, at the end things have been kind of tragic and then something really fucked up happens.
Yeah, fucked up.
Which hopefully sends the audience out on like kind of like, you know, their brains whirring. But as opposed to going with like, you know, kind of dour, spooky music at the end through the credits, I'm like, okay, let's hit the gas, you know, let's reward everybody. You know, we had a fun time. It's, you know, there's a rock and roll aspect of the movie and we wanted to have that kind of come across at the end. So I think it's a little unexpected, especially when you're watching it in the movie theater. But and again, it's a payoff for the song that everyone's been humming during the movie. Now you get to hear, you know, a studio recording of it.
It's great. I love that ending because I was going to mention that, like, he hit this happy chord right at the worst possible moment, but it works. And some of my favorite movies actually do that. And Sean, I know we probably can't name a few right now, but like just all of a sudden, it's like in your face, they're playing this. I think actually VHS might be one of those movies. I found footage, but at the very end, they always play a really cool rockin' tune, like punk rock or industrial or whatever. It takes you completely out of the context of this horrible place you were in. But
I'll give you a couple of examples that I love. So the one that probably was in the back of my mind, which doesn't even, you know, I think We Rock even harder, was American Werewolf in London.
Absolutely. There it is. That's the one.
The end of the movie, and then they play Bad Moon Rising, I believe. And you're just, and you're like, so you're going out on a high, you're not going out on a low, even though bad things have happened to our American Werewolf in London. It was a great guy until he turned into a werewolf. You know, at least we're going out bopping and, you know, dancing in our seats. And then the other one I really love is Rian Johnson at the end of Brick. I don't know if you guys remember or saw Brick, but at the end of it, the song that comes on is, and this is just a deep cut, it's the Velvet Underground Sister Ray.
Oh, no. I did not see the film.
No, neither did I.
Well, it's kind of a disreputable track because it's, you know, the Velvet Underground were like the forerunners of, you know, really smart punk rock.
Of course, Max's Kansas City days.
Oh, yeah. And this was a track where they were all like so mad at each other that everybody tried to play louder than each other and they only did like one take. And the idea that he had the like musical taste to put this super hard rocking, like slightly anarchic song on the end for the end credits of Brick. I was like, okay, I want that feeling.
Oh man. I'm thinking Captain Sexy, we got to have him on and talk about music next time.
Yeah, we got to
get some bands together, man. We could get some music you're allowed to play and we'll talk some jams.
Yeah. Right. And the other thing, too, is from a soundtrack point of view, I'm a huge fan of Bernard Herrmann, who did the score for Citizen Kane, for The Birds, for Psycho, for Taxi Driver.
Ooh, you know, nice.
This guy was like the greatest Hollywood, in my mind, the greatest Hollywood composer of all time. And so whenever I've done this with other projects, but definitely with this one with Ari, I was like, okay, let's listen to some Bernard Herrmann and you know, see what we can do.
He's a psycho. I mean, you cannot listen to that music and not, it doesn't bring you right back to that, them driving down the road and just, that you said it, you're pulling stuff out of my head right now and you're scaring me a little
bit.
Is this the nightmare code happening, Sean? Can you prevent this? Can you firewall this shit?
No, I don't think I can.
Well, you better figure it out, man, because this guest is scary.
Oh, are you guys having computer issues? Because it's funny. We're like working on set, and at certain points, people's computers wouldn't work. They go like, oh, it's Roper.
I'm telling
Roper's
you. Missing. Well, we could all say we had a little bit of a sound check issue before, but we don't know which side it was on, but I'm starting to figure it out.
We might be infected, David. We're infected.
We're infected right now. Yeah. We'll find out when I can't put this show up. But, you know, I should, since we've kind of hinted about it, we are sort of partners in crime here. Sean is meeting you for the first time, which is a big deal. And your partner in crime is Peter. And Electrocast is our new home, so to speak. We have several now. I just want to thank you for coming on and introducing you the Electrocast and to me and Martise.
The podcast network, yeah.
The podcast network. Go ahead.
Yeah, Electrocast is a podcast media company. We've got a bunch of different networks that are all based on kind of different areas that people love. And Society 13, which you and
Martise
are the network leads of and created, have brought over to Electrocast, and it's our pop culture network. You know, this is where Nightmare Code wants to be. This is where a lot of other pop culture podcasts are right now and will be.
And that being said, where do we find you, sir? Where do you want to be found? Is Nightmare Code going to be on YouTube forever?
Oh, so here's the scoop. There's a number of different YouTube places that you can watch Nightmare Code ad supported. You can watch it on Tubi TV ad supported. Mm-hmm. If you want to download a version of it, we are or rent it from, you can do it from iTunes or Google Play or just about any service will have some sort of rentable version of it. We are on Twitter. So there is a Nightmare Code handle on Twitter and on Instagram. I think Twitter's slightly more active, but it has been a while since the film's been released. I am Trink Skitz, TRINKSCHIZ on Twitter. And always happy to hear from fans and answer any questions.
And what can I say, folks? You're meeting him here on this particular podcast for the first time, but it will not be the last time. As usual with us, you could find us. Fairly Dark Productions has my stuff and my books as well, which always helps with the funding of things. Celebration of Spirits as well. I've got a couple of books on there, too, if you like your horror. And kids, you know you do. Also, iHeartRadio. You find all our stuff there. All our podcasts are there. Kettle Whistle Radio. BurningBowlPublishing.com. I got a big that's big horror publishing company out here. If you're into John Russo, who co-wrote the original Night of the Living Dead, worked with Romero, he hasn't stopped. He has like 22 books on Burning Bowl Publishing. You can find his stuff there. He's been on this show many times. And I'm proud to say I'm in that publishing company as well with my books. If I could recommend one to everybody, I always say Dwelling in the Dark because it gives you 11 short stories and you can pick it from there. But The Fall of Tomorrow was my first one. If you like Demon Apocalypse. And that's all I got, folks. I'm still at Fairly Dark on Twitter. Sean, where the hell are you?
I'm still just at Facebook and Instagram.
Instagram. Kettle Whistle Radio's there, too. Mark, thank you so much for doing this. Anything else you want to throw out there before we go?
No, I just really appreciate you guys having me on. I'm glad you enjoyed the movie. And all the questions you asked were great questions.
Well, and we got one more for you.
Mark, I actually have a question for you to wrap this all up. I was wondering, you know, ElectriCast, you know, I imagine keeps you very busy, but I'm wondering on the artistic side of yourself, where do you find yourself spending your time now? Is it in development of something else? Is it writing? Anything going on?
Great question. I am mostly focused on ElectriCast as, partners with Peter, co-founder and CEO. It really is keeping me super busy. I also do some teaching at Los Angeles Film School here in LA, so that's keeping me busy. I have been working on I do have a pilot script for something in a sci-fi vein that is not entirely dissimilar from Nightmare Code, but different in a lot of ways and very advanced and a little bit more in the future, which I'd love to get made. And then we have another script kicking around called All the Way Down, which is a thriller, a female-driven revenge thriller that takes place in a dusty army town in the Southwest.
Sean likes female revenge. It's a running joke.
I wish Sean was the studio exec and was financing the movie.
We'd get it done.
Get on that, Sean.
We'd get it done. One day of shooting. the rest in post, dear God. All right. Hey, thanks for listening, folks, friends, and fiends, all of you out there. And Mark, thanks for being a guest.
Thank you.
All right. And we're going to give them a little taste of some of your score, if that's okay.
Oh, please.
He's already tired of me. All right. Good night. Take care. Thank you.
Society 13, redefining podcasting.
Introducing the Deep Leadership Podcast. Leadership is a people business. That's the philosophy of your podcast host, John Rennie. As a former submarine officer who spent 22 years leading businesses in corporate America before starting his own manufacturing business, he knows that leadership matters.
Leadership matters.
Deep Leadership is real-world, actionable leadership advice from John and his expert guests. Become a leader worth following. Subscribe today.
Electric Acid.
Welcome to Ringside with Ray and Prince. My name is Ray Leonard Jr.
Oh, is that the set?
No, that's just my dad.
My name is Prince Daniels Jr.
Daniels again with a big hole.
On this show, we come to humanize
athletes, entertainers, business executives. We're going to see what makes them tick.
Tuesdays, 10 a.m. Pacific time on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, and wherever you get your podcasts.
We'll see you there. Peace and power.
Electric Acid. Electric Acid.
Podcast.